Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights and legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you're just going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad, and you'll be placed in a queue, and Jillian will screen your call. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose questions there. On this episode, we're focusing on what generally is referred to as blended sentencing, although many sentences states have their own terminology for it. For example, in Ohio, kids facing blended sentences are called serious youthful offenders, and in Minnesota, it's called extended jurisdiction juveniles, or EJJ. Blended sentencing emerged in the 90s as one response to the unfounded super predator theory as a compromise between those who wanted to emphasize punishment and accountability and those who wanted to maintain or strengthen the traditional juvenile justice system. Since its introduction, blended sentencing has been implemented in more than half of the states across the country. It works in various ways, but a commonality is that a youth receives an adult and juvenile sanction through the juvenile court process. How and when the adult sentence may or may not be triggered or considered is where a lot of the differences come into play. Basically, the sentencing scheme offers youthful offenders a last chance within the juvenile system by providing an incentive to abide and respond to treatment in order to avoid the consequences of an adult sentence. While some favor blended sentencing as a chance to keep kids in the juvenile system or extend jurisdiction of the juvenile court over a child beyond the age of 21, many remain concerned about its constitutionality and fairness, whether it widens the net for kids entering the adult system and increases the disparate treatment of youth of color by both the juvenile and adult criminal justice systems. And today we have three guests joining us who are going to elaborate on this debate and help educate us on blended sentencing. Dr. Chad Trulson is a professor and associate chair in the Department of Criminal Justice at the University of North Texas. Previously, Chad held various positions in juvenile justice, such as resident counselor and as a detention and parole officer. He is widely published and is currently working on a book examining the institutional misconduct and recidivism patterns of serious and violent youthful offenders sentenced to the Texas Youth Commission. He also currently serves as editor-in-chief of the highly ranked journal Youth Violence and Juvenile Justice and consults with numerous agencies, including the Texas Youth Commission, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, the California Attorney General's Office, and several law enforcement agencies on subjects ranging from racial profiling to desegregation in prison environments to institutional violence and recidivism. Donna Gilster is the program manager for juvenile probation in Hennepin County, Minnesota. Prior to this position, she was a juvenile probation officer, spending 9 of those years supervising extended jurisdiction juveniles, the EJJ. She was assigned to the EJJ probation unit when the law was first passed and participated in its implementation in Hennepin County. Donna believes that many kids can and do change and grow into productive and law-abiding members of the community. She says that in order to be effective with the EJJ population, the court needs to provide a balance of services and accountability so that kids have the skills they need to succeed as adults, and this all begins with conducting an appropriate assessment to identify the areas of need and risk. Dr. Shelley Schaefer is an assistant professor and chair in the Department of Criminal Justice and Forensic Science at Hamline University. She specializes in juvenile delinquency, juvenile justice, sociology of punishment, and policy evaluation. Previously, Shelley worked for the 4th Judicial District as a research analyst, and prior to completing graduate school, she worked for Hennepin County Community Corrections as a juvenile correctional officer and later a transitional case manager working with kids reentering the community after a period of confinement. Her dissertation work focused on state-level determinants of state passage of blended sentencing and young adults' perceptions about serving time on a blended sentence. So I'd like to welcome all three of you to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Shelley, maybe we can start with you. And I provided a little bit of background about blended sentencing. What more can you tell us?
You did provide a definitely a good summary of blended sentencing. I think one of the important things that you touched on is sort of the complex issue of sort of why it was implemented. And I think there's tension there. Was it really sort of implemented as this last chance for juveniles to sort of keep them in the juvenile justice system, or was it sort of this expansion of crime control, which is, you know, widening the net potentially or making more punitive sentencing options for juvenile court judges? And I think, you know, that's sort of one of the tensions with blended sentencing. But at a basic level, like you said, it really sort of expands the sentencing authority. And it could be in the criminal court, or the youth could stay in the juvenile court for that sentencing authority, but it expands it by combining sort of those two worlds. And, it varies by state and how it's implemented and used and what court has jurisdiction. I think, you know, at the basic level, that's really what the focus of blended sentencing is.
So maybe you can tell us more about what it looks like across the country, because I know it can be inclusive, exclusive, contiguous blends. So for people listening who have no idea what we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
maybe you can, tell us what basically they look like in some of the states, what states call it, and maybe some trends around this issue. And Chad and Donna, please feel free to contribute.
Sure. If you look at sort of a longitudinal, if you were to visualize it, it sort of began in 1985. West Virginia had one of the first states, and then Texas in 1987. And it sort of slowly started being implemented with in Minnesota in 1994, they had put together a Supreme Court advisory task group to look at it, and then it went into legislation and passed in 1995. And really between 1994 and 1998 is when we really see this explosion of states passing blended sentencing laws. And so by, 1998, about 42% of the states had some sort of blended sentencing law, and then by 2002, you had about 26 states, and that's where it remains. So just over 50% of the states have these. And what sort of emerged was two sides. So you have sort of those that sort of maintained a juvenile blended sentencing, which, the authority stays in the juvenile court, and then you had states that sort of had a criminal blended sentence where the youth sort of is transferred to the criminal court, and the criminal court then has a decision to do a juvenile disposition. And those then vary, like you said, by either exclusive or inclusive. And those, there's five models that have sort of emerged. So one being a juvenile exclusive blended sentencing that essentially allows a juvenile court to impose either a juvenile disposition or an adult sentence. And there's a juvenile inclusive, which is the Minnesota model, which essentially allows the juvenile court to impose both a juvenile disposition and a stayed adult sentence. And then the stayed adult sentence can be revoked up until age 21 for either violations or a new offense. And then the juvenile contiguous blended sentence essentially extends the juvenile sentence. And I believe, Chad, this is Texas, follows this model where once the youth reaches the ages between 19 and 21, it triggers sort of a review hearing to determine whether or not they're transferred to adult court. And then criminal exclusive is the fourth, which grants the criminal court, so we're moving over to the criminal court side, the sentencing and jurisdiction over a juvenile case. But the criminal court has this choice to impose either a juvenile disposition or a criminal adult sentence. And then lastly, a criminal inclusive model that allows the criminal court to impose both a juvenile disposition and an adult sentence, but in most cases, the criminal court suspends that adult sanction. And so those are sort of the five models that have emerged, and obviously those are very, I'm sure they're much more complex at the state level, but that is at least sort of a broad description of them.
Well, one of the things that, you know, as you're talking about all of these different variations in the types of blended sentencing that we have in the United States, or at least those states that have it, one of the larger themes that goes across all of these, whether it's inclusive, exclusive, criminal, juvenile, whoever, whichever court controls the decision-making, is the issue of fit. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking at the broader picture of blended sentencing, you know, I think one of the original goals of these strategies was to find a place for juveniles who were simply inappropriate for our traditional juvenile court, which was very rehabilitation-based, which was, you know, tried to shun incarceration if at all possible. So we have these serious kids who don't really fit there. And the other option was we could just send them to the adult court and usually adult prison. And so you have all kinds of kids who really don't fit neatly within one of those two options. And so blended sentencing supposedly was to come along and provide mm-hmm. kind of a middle-of-the-road sanction where, you know, you could kind of try some juvenile stuff, and if that didn't work, you always had that option to send them to the adult court. It was touted as to be something that featured the best of both worlds, both the juvenile system and the adult system. And that's kind of what I take away from all these different methods that occur across the country.
Terrific. Don, is there anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think that the extended jurisdiction juvenile legislation came at a time when many of, in Hennepin County, I'll speak specifically where I'm employed, is that there were cases that the court was labeling as blended. But because there was no specific legislation at that time, that it was sort of case by case. And so I think people were saying, you know, just what Chad said, is that it's sort of a little bit in juvenile, a little bit in adult, and where do we really meet the needs of public safety and services for this population? And so that really was one of the driving factors. I think they were seeing these kids commit more violent adult-like crimes, so they really didn't fit exclusively in the juvenile world, but didn't really want to put them in the adult world, and we were seeing in Hennepin County specifically a higher number of youth that were kids of color that were being certified into the adult system. And so we thought, is there a better way to do this? And so we thought extended jurisdiction juvenile really helped, I think, meet that need of that population.
Great. And so, you know, you just talked about Donna and Chad, you said sort of philosophically what the goal was, right, what the hope mm-hmm. was. So maybe it's time to start the debate and hear about what's working and what doesn't work. So let's start with what works. And Chad, do you want to start us off?
Sure. You know, I think, well, first of all, the notion of something working with blended sentencing involves a whole host of things. Does it work for the system? Does it work in terms of recidivism? Does it work for the kid? Does it work in the long term once the youthful offender has exited their blended sentence? But just at a more basic level, in terms of works, I like to look at it first from the organizational level or the juvenile system level. And one of the things that I think works is that it does provide a more flexible option for prosecutors, for judges. You know, if we look back 50 years ago when, you know, the only sanctions that we had in the criminal justice system really were probation and prison, that really limited judges. Now, over time, we've implemented boot camps and intensive forms of supervision and electronic monitoring and all these things which allow us to better tailor sentences to criminal offenders. I see blended sentencing like that. It gives us another option, especially for youthful offenders who again, are not a good fit for the traditional juvenile court and are probably not appropriate or are not old enough, for example, to be in the adult system. So in that level, it at least gives another option, and in that way it works. You know, we talk about this as being a last chance opportunity for some juveniles. And Texas in specific, you know, there's a book written about Texas's blended sentencing scheme, and it's called Last Chance in Texas. And maybe unlike other states, I'm not quite sure, but in Texas it does provide very serious and violent juvenile offenders, the most serious and violent juveniles in the state of Texas compared to waived kids or otherwise. It gives them that opportunity to prove that they are amenable to treatment, that they can change, and that they're not a predator. And in this state, over the last 25 years, this determinate sentencing, as we call it down here, has affected roughly 3,500 youthful offenders, very serious, killers, rapists, you know, as bad as it gets. And most of those do not transfer on to our prison system, but they get out of our youth facilities and they move on. Maybe some of them get rearrested down the road and end up in the adult prison, but it does serve as that last chance. And I guess finally, I guess the list could go on forever and ever here, but I think it's important to note that these types of schemes, especially the juvenile blended sentences in the states that have that, give that juvenile an opportunity to glean from the services offered in the juvenile justice system and perhaps avoid this long-term stigma associated with being convicted as an adult felon. Yeah, I don't think it's any secret that juvenile systems, juvenile institutions, are probably a better fit for juveniles than the adult system. You know, whether you're talking about recidivism, whether you're talking about the treatment they receive, all of these types of things, you know, what works with blended sentencing is allowing these youthful offenders that chance to stay in the juvenile system, which, you know, is probably better for them in terms of treatment and services.
And I think that in particular in Minnesota, when I look at the extended jurisdiction juvenile, I do think that it can work. I don't think it is an answer to all of the violent juvenile crime. In like Texas, Minnesota tends to have, and also be Kennepin County specific again, they tend to have the more violent offenders. Everything, the majority are person offenses, everything from gang-related maybe murders to assaults to criminal sexual misconduct and down the line. But with that, I think I do go back to it all begins that you need to do a proper assessment, maybe psychological evaluation, to ensure that you have someone who can adhere themselves to the treatment, to the services, and have an interest in it. I do think there are some youth that we see that pose such a significant issue to public safety that may not be an option. But I do think the majority of them can, and I do think they benefit long-term, specifically in Hennepin County, the EJJ youth, and that's extended jurisdiction juvenile. We see an increase, a huge increase, in those that are part of that supervision model, completing their high school education and going on to post-secondary, and that may be vocational and or four-year college. But we haven't seen that in the juvenile system to this degree. And granted, some are older, but I think the attending education is a mandate here. And you don't get an option when you hit 18 to say, well, I'm grown and I'm going to, you know, not go to school. It is a mandate. And because of that, it opens the doors for employment and sort of being, I think, returning to more productive kind of lives. So I think it can work. I don't think it's the answer for all youth who commit violent crimes.
I can come in as a few challenges that I, you know, and some of this is from my work in juvenile corrections. I was actually a correction officer from 1999 to 2002, which was about 4 years after blended sentencing was our EJJ or extended jurisdiction juvenile was passed in Minnesota. And at the time, I was a juvenile correctional officer at a facility. And interestingly, we knew, you know, this law had passed, and you would have thought the youth that were coming in on EJJ would be drastically different. And I think what Donna brought up as an important point is that I think one of the issues is that there wasn't a great change sometimes in the youth that were, at least at that time, that were being sentenced to EJJ. And so it sort of is, are we identifying the right individuals, which, you know, some work, at least on Minnesota populations, have said, you know, it's widened the net. It essentially has brought more youth into adult corrections by these stayed sentences, and then due to a new offense or a violation, they end up, you know, revoking that stayed sentence, and they execute their sentence, and they're in prison. So, of course, that's one of the challenges to it. The other interesting piece, I think, that Minnesota, and it might be unique to Minnesota, is that if a youth is 16 or 17 and has a presumptive commit offense or an offense that if you're adult, it would be, you know, presumed that you would do prison time. And let's say, you know, there's a motion filed for certification. If that file, or if that motion is does not, it essentially is a failed certification motion, the only option the judge has then is EJJ. And so one of the issues, particularly with some of the interviews that I did for my dissertation research, which of course is a small sample, so I'm not trying to generalize this, but many of the youth talked about it as a plea bargaining tool. So, you know, in some sense, some of the, you know, prosecutors would say, look, I'm going to, you know, move towards certification, or if you plead guilty, you know, you can, we'll move forward with this EJJ sentence. And so I think what Donna picked up on is that maybe we're not there yet with the identification, because if it's a plea bargaining sort of, you know, in sort of a tool for plea bargaining, then that's not really getting at maybe the youth that it's intended for. You know, and so I think that is probably one of the tensions. If it's truly rehabilitative, you know, is this a high-risk, high-need kid, or is it a low-risk, high-need, you know, all those sorts of issues come into play.
Well, I think that, you know, there are a lot of questions out there in terms of why do some offenders get blended sentences versus other sanctions, and why this and why that. And you know, if you look at these laws, you know, one of the things that strikes me in terms of who is subjected to this is that after a youth meets, you know, usually these have certain age requirements. In Texas, you can be prosecuted as a blended sentence offender as long as you're age 10 to 16. And then usually there's an offense trigger. In our state, there are 30 different offenses that if you commit, you can be prosecuted under determinate sentencing. But beyond that, a lot of this comes down to prosecution discretion. And we don't know a whole lot about that in terms of how that affects determinate sentencing. We can look at our own jurisdictions and know that prosecutors have a wide range. And if you jump from county to county, you know, the criteria as to whether someone is waived or not waived or waived versus blended sentencing is very individualized. It's very prosecutor-specific. And, you know, that prevents us from having a really good idea of, you know, who should be subject to this and who shouldn't be, those types of issues.
Shelley, and you mentioned that research, and there's been research in several states that it also has contributed to disproportionate minority contact. So I don't know if the three of you have anything to say about that issue as a challenge specifically.
I think that's always a concern. I mean, I think that was a concern as to why in Minnesota extended jurisdiction juvenile you know, was considered, because we were seeing, particularly in Hennepin County, we were seeing that disproportionate number of kids of color were the ones that were being waived into adult court or were being certified into adult court. And so that continues to be an issue across the board, just of kids involved in corrections, period. And so I think that was there. I speak from our state. That was there in the very beginning as to one of the things that maybe that would slow down or at least make us pause and make a concerted effort to how can we address that. So I don't think we have any magic. I don't think this was the answer in the sense that it's going to cure all of that, but I still think that was an issue back in the mid-90s here, and it continues to be an issue.
The other thing, I know, well, we have blended sentencing here in Ohio, which I mentioned, and we call it serious youthful offenders, SYOs. So there's been legal challenges to it here, and I'm assuming that legal challenges have happened in other states as well. So I don't know if you want to highlight any of those debates and what's happening here in Ohio. There was challenges about constitutionality because, in juvenile court, there's not a jury trial where if you were in the adult court system and you were going to be sent to prison, you would have a right to a jury trial. And so that someone, a kid could get imposed, sent to prison without having his peers weigh in and make a decision about that. The other thing is whether the jurisdiction could extend beyond 21 and who could impose that. So those were some of the sort of the legal debates and challenges here. What's happening across the country and where are states falling?
I could speak a little bit to some, in, I guess, Minnesota, but I think that constitutionality issue is probably across the board in these blended sentencing states of, if I'm now revoked and then, you're going to, now you're executing my adult sentence, but yet the same due process wasn't afforded to me, is that constitutional? Obviously is an issue. And I think another issue that is popping up in Minnesota that is actually, has tried to make it into legislation is sort of the sealing of these juvenile records, because oftentimes, for some of these youth that are 16 to 17 with some presumptive commit offenses, not necessarily even EJJ, their records aren't sealed. And some of these youth, end up maybe thinking, okay, if I, plead guilty to this EJJ sentence, I'm not certified, I don't have sort of the conviction or the felony stigma on my record, but realistically, it's becoming more of an issue that these youth, employers, housing, do find this on their record. And even though it says adjudicated delinquent, the arrest is there, the sort of case is there, and that can be very stigmatizing. And I think for the youth then that maybe are technical violators or end up with a new offense and they, they do go serve time, that sentence then becomes part of their, even though it started as a juvenile offense, it becomes part of their adult criminal record. And, many people have spoken about sort of the collateral consequences of that. And I don't know, Donna might be able to shed light or chat about how many youth are actually, are revoked, as part of that sentence.
Yeah, and I think that there's a couple of things. Like I said, when extended jurisdiction started in Minnesota, those records were juvenile records and they were kept private. Then there was this movement to open the court process. And so when kids 16 and older appear in court, they're open court hearings. So that sort of started that whole thing where we see our youth applying for jobs when they're 18, 19, and then people do background checks. They're seeing all of that, but they're misinterpreting what it means. And so that's sort of been one issue that we have seen. In Minnesota, our kids' youth, when they are blended sentenced or they're coming in for an EJJ, they have a right to a jury trial. In the same process, we call it a Morrissey hearing, but if there's ever a condition that's violated and we bring the youth back to court for a violation hearing, we call it a Morrissey, and the adult process has to be followed and the adult conditions have to be met. And so if we say we recommend that youth be revoked and committed to the Commissioner of Corrections, which is we're saying they should be committed to the adult prison on the adult sentence, then we have to meet the same criteria that the adult side does. And so I think that's where you're going to see the majority of the differences in that whole due process and then just the process that each state sort of follows.
So before we turn to, how it's working on the ground, just want to see if there's anything else you want to say on like a policy, trend level, or legislative. It seems like the number of states has sort of held steady now. Is there, for the 26 states, are they working on changes? Do you see other states looking at, implementing a blended sentencing, or the ones that have it deciding that maybe it's not working and trying to get rid of it?
Since Ohio, I believe in 2002 was the last state that actually, to my knowledge anyway, that had passed legislation for it. I mean, the bulk, if you were to map out blended sentencing adoption with sort of the, you know, the kind of juvenile crime boom of the late 80s and the 90s, I mean, it follows almost pretty well that same curve. And so it did slow down as juvenile crime, you know, started to decline. So you kind of saw this, although it sort of declined at after some of the juvenile crime boom was sort of slowing down. But it really was a bulk in the 90s. And, you know, that sort of, was it sort of another means to bring kids in, or was it, an alternative to these direct file and transfer laws, which at that time all 50 states were making changes to their transfer and direct file laws. You know, so it's been interesting that it, and I haven't, to my knowledge, any states reversing it.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you're right, there has not been a tremendous amount of activity, you know, legislatively with blended sentencing, other states getting it, or, you know, as you mentioned, other states abandoning it. You know, in terms of trends, I wanted to mention just a couple things. One is that, at least in Texas, and I'm not aware of any analysis elsewhere that has looked at this, but in Texas, when this law was passed, you noted a pretty large drop in the amount of youth that were waived to the adult court system, and that has been consistent over the 25 years this law has been in place. I think, you know, if possible, they tend to favor this instead of waiver. But again, it's very county specific. But, you know, the other thing in terms of trends, and you know, if I were to make a guess, and I don't have a crystal ball here with me today, I'll bring it tomorrow. But I think blended sentencing is generally, in terms of the public, I think they find it attractive. And, you know, most of the public doesn't hear about it or know about what it is, but there is research out there that is starting to ask, you know, do you like, instead of waiver, what if we implemented a process where, you know, we gave a juvenile a second chance, and if they did good or if they, you know, made progress, that they could avoid prison time? And the public generally, in terms of their attitudes towards crime and punishment, they like to have options and they like alternatives. And oftentimes, especially for juveniles, even serious and violent juveniles, they tend to support a lesser option. The lesser option being blended sentencing versus prison. So even though there's not a lot of change legislatively, I think there's trends in terms of this being a fairly popular sentencing vehicle when people are educated about it.
You use the term terminology waiver. So I don't know if everyone listening knows what that is. Can you explain that briefly?
It's waiver, certification, adult court transfer. They all mean the same thing. It's just the term that I use more frequently. But it talks about youth being sent to the adult court system,
right,
not as a blended sentence offender.
Right. Thank you. Well, you know how we call it bind over here. I just want to make sure.
Bind over. Okay. There's one
I've heard too. We're unique. So I do want to remind our listeners that they can ask questions in the chat room, but if they want to ask our guests a question live on air, to call 347-994-1149, 347-994-1149, press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, so let's talk about the realities on the, you know, working with kids who have a blended sentence disposition on them. Donna, Chad, especially Donna, you know, you used to work with these kids day in, day out. What is the reality of the situation about the coordination of services, some unintended consequences, and, you know, maybe some things that you found that really worked that you didn't expect to work?
Well, I think it all started, let's say it started in 1995. In Hennepin County, each county had sort of an opportunity to develop their own plan of how they were going to address it. And obviously, Hennepin County has the majority of kids on probation. It's a big metropolitan area, and so we had a large number of kids that fell in this category. Initially, the law also had funding attached, so there was some monies that came with it that sort of allowed each county to do something maybe that they didn't already or weren't already doing. That has since gone away, so that's sort of a consequence, I would say, and I think a lot of counties reverted back to sort of dealing with the EJJ offender like they would any other offender. And at Hennepin County, we decided we were going to try approach a bit differently, and so we created a team approach. We have 8 probation officers assigned to that unit. They each are partnered with what we call a community worker or community specialist. And we believe there's a balance of highly accountability, given that these are pretty, for the most part, violent offenders, violent juvenile offenders, and then partner with a community person who will help introduce that young person to pro-social activities in the community, help monitor education, mental health needs, you know, help prepare for employment interviews, that kind of thing. So we have really developed this as a team approach. We supervise together. We support each other. There's people on call. We just decided that we couldn't do it as is. And so this is what we consider our intensive supervision unit. They're seen and talked to and followed up several times a week, sort of a phased-out program. We also conduct an aftercare group with this population where we bring them together and sort of talk about what's been going on, how we can support each other as the youth, and just another way for us to see them maybe in the middle of the week to ensure that everything's on page. The biggest concern is always going to be public safety. I mean, some of these kids are on for murder charges. Some are on for serious assaults. And so that's the balance always is how do you monitor closely so the public feels safe in having this population return to the community. In addition, how do you get the needs met in terms of services so they can address any outstanding chemical, mental health, education, any kind of issues that may exist?
Well, if I could jump in here real quick just to kind of reiterate in terms of, you know, how this works on the ground, at least in the state of Texas, I think there is a concern because most of the youth that are dealt with through blended sentencing in Texas do not go on probation initially. What they do is they go to our Texas Youth Commission facilities, and I think a concern out there is that these offenders, which almost all of them are exclusively just serious and violent, and I think the concern is that they go to these institutions and they kind of fake it, they fake it to make it type of a thing, and you know, really they're only going to stay in there on average about 3 years until they reach the age at which a determination needs to be made as to whether they're getting out on the streets or they're going to go to the adult prison system. And so, again, just in terms of day-to-day, how this works, concerns with that, I think that's a real big one here. You know, we have very serious and violent offenders who serve 3 years in our facilities, and then we have to make a decision. And, you know, in Texas, most of them don't go on to the adult system. 70%, a little over 70%, are going to hit the streets.
And then, Chad, are they no longer supervised?
Most of those who so-called hit the streets do enter parole, whether it's juvenile or adult parole. It depends on their age. The majority of those will be on that sanction. But nonetheless, they are on the streets. And again, you know, in this state, we're not talking about, you know, kids who vandalize or steal a candy bar. I mean, capital murderers, serious robbery, aggravated sexual assaults, that, you know, the defined list of crimes that will get you prosecuted under blended sentencing in Texas are extremely serious. Probably the least serious offense in this state is having being a habitual offender with 3 felonies. And that is
research has also shown, though, that risk and the actual crime committed don't necessarily go hand in hand as well. right, for kids. And
well, I'd say a capital murderer is pretty risky regardless.
But, I mean, you all mentioned risk assessments in the beginning because there's also been concern over time that, you know, putting kids away for 3 years without comprehensive programming, right? I mean, kids can get worse, too. So it's really about this balance of how we are helping to rehabilitate. You're all talking about the concerns. I'm thinking there's also been some significant changes, like, Donna, that you've seen in kids through this team approach of, you know, holistic services. Do you want to talk about those as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think the team approach certainly for us is working. But I think in addition, our county, Hennepin County, has also incorporated evidence-based practices, which we look at programs and services that have sort of a record of working, you know, and we try to incorporate those throughout. And one of those is assessments. And so, you know, whether you're EJJ client or you're a lower end juvenile, we're going to assess you and see where your high-risk domains are, and then we're going to place you at a program that we feel can meet those, whether it's community-based or placement. Obviously, those that are the higher-risk violent offenders are going into institutions, but we reassess every the 6 months into the placement and every 90 days after that. It would really be sort of unheard of here for us to have someone in placement beyond a year. And that's where we do the intensive supervision as a step down. That seems to work. Also with that is, it is that additional support, I think, by having a probation officer and a community specialist assigned to each youth. For us, it's sometimes the probation officer may be seen as the, you know, accountability one, and so the youth may not want to approach them initially if something's going on. This way they have two professionals that are teaming and partnering each case. So if I'm, as a probation officer in court on a case, we're not waiting for something to blow up in a placement or school setting. We're getting someone out to that setting to help de-escalate, to help process, and say, how can we sort of make this work and not have a violation come out of this or have you return into our detention center? And I'm not, by saying that it works for us, I'm not saying it's perfect. We have our fair share of youth that are violating. But each year we have to assess about what kind of a client are we getting. I mean, when I started with EJJ in the 1990s, the kind of client that we're seeing is totally different than then. So we need to reassess and update our programming to meet the needs and the risk levels of the youth that we see. The one thing that amazed me is just the number of kids and young adults that are really getting their education. And with that, I think the doors around, I really can maybe go to college, or I maybe can go to vocational school and get a job with a living wage in order to support me and my family, that's been huge for us. And so we've started a employment readiness program to really sort of support that. You know, you get an 18, 19-year-old, do we want them to go out and earn a living on the streets, or do we want to put some things in place so they can get a job? And it's not going to be successful for everyone, but we do see some success with that.
And that was going to really lead me into, you know, my next question about programming that has been maybe specifically developed for this population. I mean, Chad, you're talking, it is a high-risk population, mm-hmm. So maybe even in Texas, have some evidence-based unique programs been created, or, you know, Shelley, if you know of any around the country that you can see some success in working with kids who are in blended sentencing?
Well, in Texas, we have a fairly unique program. It was originally called the Capital Offenders Group. Now it's called the Serious and Violent Offender Treatment Program, and it was named that after our law expanded to include more than just homicide offenders. And a very intensive treatment program, which focuses on things like empathy building and responsibility and more of this restorative justice many of the offenders will go through, but not all of them. It's a very small group format. And, you know, at any given time in the state, you might have 400 blended sentenced offenders in our institutions, and it just doesn't, there's just not enough room for them. But beyond that, you have the usual list of options available. chemical dependency treatment, sex offender treatment. These are all intensive ones, mental health treatment. And then your general institutional programs for our offenders. So, yeah, there are all kinds of programs they can benefit from, provided they choose to do so. Mm-hmm. And on a very large scale, their progress and participation in those programs will determine what happens to them when they have a hearing to determine if they're going to go to prison or get out on the streets, whether on parole or not. Where I have a little bit of a concern, and it sounds like Minnesota is doing a really good job, but where my concern is we put a lot of emphasis in Texas on what happens in the institutions, but when they get out, there seems to be a little dip maybe in services or availability of services or coordination of those services.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a parole officer for the Youth Commission, that you know, they have the AA programs and this and that, but Donna, those things you mentioned about, you know, with college prep or job training,
mm-hmm.
and meeting with basically mentors, that is really attractive, I think, for these types of offenders, and certainly more of that can never hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I think one thing to add is that, I obviously worked with some of the earlier EJJ youth when I was a correctional officer, and then when I was a transitional caseworker, I was working with youth who were sort of 2 to 4 weeks from leaving the institution, and many of those youth at the time were on EJJ. And, you know, part of this, you know, having something hanging over your head, such as a Minnesota state adult sentence, is hopefully a motivator, you know, when we talk about recidivism. But I think one of the interesting things, and I know Donna touched on this with sort of the reduction of resources that comes up, is that, you know, although we can sort of have EJJ, you know, having this carrot, I guess you could say, to abide and be a law-abiding citizen, but the real struggles that I think some of these youth that become young adults, because they can be on probation until they're 21, still face is these issues surrounding housing and employment. And, you know, those issues, and that's across the board, I think, for not only juveniles but also adults. And so I think that the real focus, and I think Chad alluded to this, is that that's really where the focus should be. You know, it's not so even so much the supervision, but at a resource level, what are we doing then, you know, to really make or help or assist this person, you know, to get into housing. I mean, I had, when in my interviews, I mean, there were some youth that simply, and maybe Donna, this has changed, but that there's certain halfway houses or group homes that won't take youth who are on EJJ.
Yeah.
And so if you're a young person and you're coming out of one of our institutions and home really isn't a viable option, and, you know, some of the group homes that are saying, you know, we'll take a straight juvenile disposition type person but not an EJJ person, and then there's been a reduction in funding for Hennepin County Probation to sort of have first month's rent or some of these issues, you know, that is still such a big problem, you know, that the carrot hanging over your head that, you know, you could go 48 months or 60 months in prison, the juveniles and youth will say, yeah, you know, that makes me think twice, but it still doesn't help me with those other struggles to be a productive sort of citizen.
Yeah, and I think that will always be an issue. Housing, those kind of things will always be an issue. I do think that what we have had to do, we've been forced to because we do have large numbers in our county, is that we are now, we had to go to those group homes and foster homes and say, could you take, I know they're high risk and I know that they're in for a really serious crime, can you take them and how would you feel comfortable taking them and not put other kids at risk? And partly what that was is that's where we started being on call 24/7. You know, we have a rotation. And that was by us being available by phone, no matter what time of day or night, we introduced these kids to some group homes that ended up being great resources. But on the other hand, you have sophisticated kids, and we've also had to look at resources, you know, that we dip in a little bit to the adult halfway house population. You know, there's some of those that have the young offenders. And so for some of the really high risk, you know, kids, we have to look at that as an option. And so you're right. I think housing will always be an issue. Even if our kids, let's say they succeed or fail, so whether they end up going to prison or they really succeed on EJJ probation, we still get a call a year later saying, I'm losing my housing. Are there any resources? And then we sort of redirect them to in their communities where they can find that. I think that's always going to be an issue, and I wish that we could see more housing opportunities for first-time renters that have these kind of, you know, criminal histories that sort of follow them.
Donna, do you have any other tips or advice that you would share to other, like, probation officers or supervisors listening across the country about what it would what it takes to successfully work with these kids and make a difference?
Yeah, you know, and I don't want anyone to leave here thinking, wow, Hennepin County has all the answers. And it's so easy, and, you know, they're going to, you know, make millions of bucks by selling this program. It really is a lot of hard work. We miss the mark on some things, but we really do go back to basics about let's not just throw this population at placements or at a certain facility if it hasn't proven to work. So we really do look at only using programs that we feel are evidence-based practice. We do really good assessments, and we continue to address it. And part of it for us is partnering with community agencies. I mean, every youth that comes in on an EJJ caseload has that community member and a probation officer. And I just feel like that's such a nice balance. And I think that's been one of the things that we've done the best at. It's just realizing we can't be everything to anybody. And so I think it's also, you know, joining up with other counties. When EJJ happened, we met with several of the counties in this area. We call it the metro area. We met with them and shared ideas and shared, you know, like, this is what we're doing. Is it working for you? Will it work for you? And so I think we all felt we were in the same boat, and so we might as well just open the doors and communicate in a way that we hadn't done before.
And Shelley and Chad, anything you want to add about, like, recommendations and considerations for maybe the judiciary or people working on a policy level about blended sentencing?
I mean, I think part of my interest is obviously research, and, you know, working with juvenile data can be difficult. You know, there's several layers of, obviously, security that's involved. But I would like to see some more studies that get at, you know, some of the issues around prosecutorial discretion or even recidivism studies, which don't always tell the whole picture. I mean, you can't neatly fit something into a number. And even some qualitative work, you know, following over a long period of time some of these youth that are, you know, were on a blended sentence. And so I think, you know, hopefully that would inform future policy, is to sort of look at, you know, what do we know now, and some of that is research, which it can be difficult when you're asking or trying to access juvenile data.
I would just second the research part of things, definitely. And, you know, I think there's a lot of mysticism around just how these things actually work in terms of decisions as to, Shelley, you mentioned prosecutorial decision-making, and, you know, I have questions about, you know, the decision as to, you know, who goes to prison versus who gets released. Sometimes it doesn't seem like there's much rhyme or reason to that, and I think that's because these cases are just so highly individualized, and I don't think you can just neatly categorize them in such a way where you can provide a list and say, these are the things that, you know, if we can check these boxes, you go to prison. If we don't check them, you get out. And any sort of research or otherwise that can, I guess, dig a little deeper into who gets what and why is certainly beneficial, not only from an academic standpoint, but for policymakers to really understand if these types of mechanisms are fulfilling their intended objective or if they're just failing on certain regards.
So if I was to convince the three of you to get back, you know, come back in 2 years onto the radio show, I hope I could convince you. what other changes would you like to have seen been accomplished? I heard you both, Shelley and Chad, you're talking about more research. Are there other things that you would like to see changes being made or things we'd know in 2 years from now?
Well, I'll throw this out here, and maybe I'm reiterating what we already talked about, but in terms of day-to-day operation, and maybe just I'm talking just about the state of Texas, but I think this maybe would apply everywhere,
mm-hmm.
is that I think there should be much more emphasis on what happens when they get out. It just seems like a waste if you're going to do something like this and maybe lock a kid up in a juvenile facility for 3 years or whatever long it may be, and then you know open the door and say good luck. And you know that's probably not an accurate picture of how it really works, but you know, I think the emphasis must be placed upon what happens when they hit the streets, because I think there's a really wide canyon between what happens in an institution and what looks like progress and change in an institution, and then when someone walks out on the street and doesn't have that protective blanket, if you will, anymore. And you know, I'm not blaming systems or anything like that, but it seems like that should be a pretty large focus of efforts if blended sentencing is going to continue in the future, you know, in my opinion.
And I think that the ongoing assessment of each, you know, sort of agency to sort of do the recidivism, to do the research and say, is what we're doing have a positive impact? Is it negative? Where are we dropping the ball? I mean, I think that's got to be consistent. And sometimes if you want to do that individually, but to do it system-wide can be a bit difficult to get all of the stakeholders on the same page.
Mm-hmm. And I think I can second what Chad and both Donna have talked about is, and something that I'm particularly interested in is what Chad said, is when you have someone who's a young adult and spending, you know, whether it's 1 year or 3 years in a facility, you know, often these are sort of in that transition time of their life. You know, they're 15 to 18, and then, you know, they walk out the door, and now society says, you know, you should be a young adult. But, you know, when you're in an institution in a controlled setting like that, even if you have programming, like Chad said, it's not the same as what you and the decisions and sort of the things that you're going to be faced with on the ground running. And I will say, you know, when I worked in Hennepin County and the fact that they had developed a transitional unit at a facility and the youth were there 2 to 4 weeks before their release, they went to their home-based schools. They took a bus from the facility, which I know at the time was, you know, people were like, you're going to allow someone who's supposed to be locked in this facility to take a bus to their home school. And it, you know, the thought process was, you know, intensive aftercare plan is to say, wouldn't we rather have them test the water now where we can regroup? And, you know, I think there should be a stronger emphasis on that. And I think it goes along with, you know, you can't really test the waters in a facility. You know, there's just a level of control that does need to be there to a certain extent. And, you know, how do we really know what that youth needs until they're sort of out there testing the water?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're at our time, and I just wanted to know if any of you actually had a story that you wanted to share of a youth that, you know, this worked for, that it really made a difference in his or her life.
Yeah, I mean, I can give an example. I'm not going to name any names, obviously, but I, you know, one of my first cases was a young man, 15, on for intentional murder, second degree. And there was such a push politically to have him certified. But after looking at all of the factors, the judge made a decision that this person could be successful in the juvenile system given intensive supervision and services. Young man read at first grade level when I first met him. He ended up getting, and I'm cutting a lot of the details out. There's a lot of hard work on his end, on our end, on the treatment programs that worked with him. His mom was diligent in working collaboratively with all of us. The young guy did a lot of work on his own. But in the end, he ended up getting, you know, a scholarship to a university to play football. And I don't think that would have ever been possible. And I'm not saying we created that, but it was just the combination of all of the elements coming together. And I do think there's something about, at one point we really did, I think, a better assessment of who's really appropriate for a blended sentence and who's not. Because some people, I think, do say, oh, I really don't want to go to the adult system, and so I'm going to stay in the juvenile system, and they really have no intention of changing a behavior. Where I think when everyone's on the same page, it can work beautifully, and it keeps this person, you know, out of the adult system and becoming sort of, you know, exposed to further delinquents and criminals, and then hopefully that breaking the pattern. And he remains in contact with me on and off, and so does his mom. And I just think I always look to that where there was so much pressure to do the opposite, but the judge had the courage to say, you know, this is a good candidate for this, and we're going to stand by him. And it really was one of my success stories.
Great. Thank you so much. And Don and Shelley, Chad, thank you so much for being on the show as well. I think, you know, being open to debating both sides of the issue and showing our listeners how complicated it is, but also the possibilities for kids has been really useful. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next show will examine the concept of restorative justice and how it's being used in juvenile courts across the country. So to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.